welcome to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff. The show is heard on WBCQ The Planet every Monday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can also listen to it on YouTube. We upload some of the programs, and this one will definitely upload. Our YouTube channel is Camp Constitution. Also, Podomatic. Go to our website at campconstitution.net, and you'll see a link to Podomatic, where we have not only well, we have this show on there, but we've got some real classic show interviews of people like Gary Allen and many other folks from the 70s and 80s, as well as some of the more recent interviews we've done here on this show. Also, one more place is IPMNation.org on Saturday afternoons at 1:30 or 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can pick up that show. It's a 24-hour online news source. Based out of Concord, New Hampshire. And this show is heard on, WBCQ, which broadcasts out of beautiful Monticello, Maine. And it is the show was sponsored by Camp Constitution. You can visit our website, campconstitution.net. Well, I'm very happy to have Tom DeWeese as a guest on today's show. Tom, how are you doing?
Doing well, Hal. Thanks for having me.
Well, you were a guest on, I'd say about a year and a half ago. Tom is the founder and president of American Policy Center. And Tom, tell us a little bit about American Policy Center. Then we'll want to get into two topics, the Article 5 Convention, which is something that your organization has been strongly opposing, as well as the Agenda 21. And let me say that, Tom, you are probably the most one of the top, if not the top, experts on the country, probably around the world, since a lot of people around the world aren't as well informed on this subject as they should be, on the topic of Agenda 21. So tell us a little bit about your organization.
Yeah, American Policy Center was founded back in 1986. We were originally called the Foreign Policy Center, and we worked we did election observations in Panama. We worked with the Contras. Various other freedom groups in Angola and things like that. And then as time went by, I began to see, I was very concerned about the environmental movement and what it was doing to private property rights, and began to look into that. And one thing led to another, and then, of course, in 1992, Agenda 21 came along and had all the my fears in one place. And that's become our real center of our battle ever since, trying to expose it and tell people what that's all about.
You know, what's fascinating, back in as the Vietnam War was winding down in the late 60s and early 70s, that's when we saw this modern-day environmental movement. And I think it's important to point out that we have an obligation to be good stewards of the earth that God gave us. So it's not that we have any objections of why stewardship and the proper use of the land. It's this environmental movement, and they used to refer to these environmentalists, that still do, as watermelons, green on the outside, red on the inside. And I remember an article by Gary Allen. He wrote this in the early 70s, and we actually have this article archived. I should make it available to people so they can. He was writing about just how Earth Day got started. They chose Lenin's birthday, just a coincidence, of course. And I think it was 1969, if I'm not mistaken, was the first Earth Day. And then he had books like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which came out in the early 60s, Alarmist, and Paul Ehrlich. And I don't think too many people took him serious, but as time went on, it became almost the policy that was ingrained. And in your presentations, you correctly point out that every single town in the United States, city, county, is involved in this to some extent. So let's start off. Let's just talk a little bit about the Article 5 Convention first, as we get into Agenda 21. Tom, now your group has been very much opposed to this. So give the listeners some reasons why this Article 5 must be opposed.
Well, first of all, I've written an article talking about the key word to opposing this, and that key word is precedent. The proponents of the Article 5 Convention, first of all, tell us that this is something completely different from a con-con. And I keep reading Article 5, and what I keep seeing is that it still says you have to apply to Congress. It still says that Congress will decide once they call this convention, and they will decide who the delegates are and how the delegates are chosen and things like that. So it is completely bogus to say that the states can control this. First of all, that's the precedent. That's number one precedent. You know, the only Article 5 or con-con we've ever had was in 1787. And at that time, the states were coming together because they had trouble with interstate commerce, and they wanted to work out problems with that. And several states, a majority of the states, were told by their state governments that the delegates to this were not to discuss a constitution, to change anything like that. They were simply to go in there and talk about this Interstate Commerce Commission or a situation. And they immediately go in there, the doors are shut, the windows are shut, and a constitution is put on the table, and that's what they did. That's a precedent, and that is exactly what I fear is going to happen with an Article 5 convention, is that no matter how many rules that the states give their delegates when they get in there, they're the most powerful force in the country at that time because they have no boss. They can do what they want to do. And then you get into how are the delegates chosen? In our atmosphere today, can you imagine the process we'll go through deciding who the delegates will be, that we have to have a certain representation of every single little minute minority group in the country who have, you know, very left-wing ideas, as you can imagine. And then the other thing that comes up, the proponents of the Article 5 Convention keep telling us that it's like they live in some kind of a dream world, that there are no liberals in the world.
That's
that
right.
They're not going to have – you're not going to be involved at all.
What I tell people is that they think Mike Farris is going to host it at Patrick Henry College, and all the delegates will be his graduates, you know.
Exactly.
And that's it.
Exactly,
although
yeah,
that would be reason for concern because Mike Farris is more of a neocon, you know. So, but even if that were the case, I'd still be concerned about it. But that's their thinking.
Yeah, and they pretend like the left isn't involved. The left is sitting there rubbing their hands together saying, come on, you stupid conservatives, put this together, and boy, we're going to take over. You know, have you heard of the Constitution 2020 movement?
Yes,
and,
that's right.
And this is funded by George Soros. And, you know, the things that they want to talk about, you know, they're putting there are several constitutions. There's a green constitution they're proposing. There are all kinds of these constitutions. And, you know, here they are proposing, you know, these progressive ideas and so forth. Then they tell us that don't worry about what happens at the convention because then it has to be ratified by the states. And so that's not a problem. Well, first of all, go back to the precedent. The Articles of Confederation that were the government of our country before the Constitution said that any changes to the Articles of Confederation would take 100% of the states.
That's right.
Now, I don't know about you, but I think when you're proposing a brand new Constitution, that is a change in the Articles of Confederation, you know. And what they ended up – the new Constitution – said, what was it, three-fourths of the states had to ratify it. Yeah. Well, somehow...
You know, an interesting an interesting fact is, as you know, Rhode Island did not attend the convention, but they sent a letter to the convention basically saying, no matter what you do, we still have to agree. So you can do all you want to, but if we don't approve of it, it's not going to happen. Well, they said, yeah, that's what you think, Rhode Island, and we're going to lower the... Was it two-thirds? I think nine states had to approve.
Two-thirds.
And two-thirds is hard to get. And three-fourths is what is what's required, three-fourths of the states. Or, and this is a fact that the most of the people who testify in favor of one never tell the committee, the members of the committee hearing this. They'll say, there's no way any crazy amendment can get through. Three-fourths of the states have to approve. Well, we can say that crazy amendments have passed 100 years ago, but what if Congress decides, no, we're going to go through the, we're going, instead of going through the three-fourths of the states, we're going to have ratifying committees or ratifying conventions. So state legislators may never get a chance to hear it. They can also, why can't they lower the to a simple majority? I mean, if they could have done it in 1787, violating, and again, I'm not suggesting, this is one of the criticisms that we get, that we claim that the U.S. Constitution was illegal. These folks represented the people, the sovereign people who created the United States Articles of Confederation. They gave us the Declaration of Independence. So they may have been appointed by the state governments, but they were not agents of the state governments. They were agents of the people, and that was why they did what they did. So the thought of the argument that Mike Farris points out, the straw man argument, is that every opponent of an Article 5 claims the Constitution was illegally adopted, and that's simply not true. So,
yeah. And then you go back to, you know, this idea that well, we're protected by the states if anything happens. We're talking about a day and age today where 75% of the American people opposed Obamacare, but they got that through anyway. 75%
right.
of the American people oppose illegal immigration, but they do it anyway. So now we're talking about we're going to be protected by the states. You know, Phyllis Schlafly, who fought the Equal Rights Amendment back in the 70s, told the story about how she would win in states and stop the amendment there, and they would bring it up again, and they would change it again, and they would, you know, she'd have to fight that state all over again. This is what's going to happen. And of course, Hal, you know, this, the bottom line is there's nothing wrong with the Constitution. It's, you know, we don't
That's
need
right.
all these amendments about balanced budgets and, you know, that kind of thing. The problem is that they're ignoring the Constitution. And I keep asking the question, okay, we get this new Constitution, we get this these amendments in there. So what magic thing is going to happen that makes everybody pay attention to it now that they don't, you know, at this point? It's just a totally bogus argument.
As the Convention of States, they talk about the structural change that we don't have, and this is in some of their videos, so they'll say, we don't have to change personnel, we have to change the structure. But it's almost as if I have a bad football team, and I'm simply going to change the rules, and all of my bad players who can't run, can't throw, can't catch, and can't block are going to become Hall of Fame candidates because I've now changed the rules. It's like, gee, I can't slam dunk anymore, so I'm going to lower the net a couple of feet. Then I'm going to look like Michael Jordan. I think what they're trying to do is make the Constitution Common Core compliant. That's, I think, one of the takeaways from this. So right now, Tom, there are 28 states that have applications for an Article 5 for a balanced budget, and we want to point out that you can't limit at a convention. I think the saving grace is there are a lot of these resolutions that go back to as far as the 70s and even 60s, so Congress may not acknowledge them. What's interesting, too, is that the Convention of States folks will tell us, it's not a con-con, that's wrong, that's a lie. Well, a lot of these applications have the terminology Constitutional Convention right in them. So I guess according to the Convention of States, these are null and void, and maybe they'll help us get these repealed. You know, I don't think so.
You can hope, but then again, we have Paul Ryan in charge of Congress. So
we have no
no expectations.
A couple of other things too before we get into the Agenda 21. States, they tell us that at this convention, it doesn't matter how many delegates, it'll be one state, one vote. Well, that may happen, but you also may have states going by electoral college members. And there's nothing stopping that, and that's more democratic and it's more progressive. So California, with its 54 or 56 or whatever they have, they may have 56 votes at an Article 5 convention, where you have some of these more smaller conservative states that only have a few delegates, Idaho, Montana, and so forth. So that's another issue too. And we're told that Congress is dysfunctional, and yeah, I agree with that. But the people who vote for these folks are the ones that are dysfunctional because they keep on putting them in there. And there's nothing stopping members of Congress to be delegates to this convention. Is that true? I mean, nothing in the Constitution. They say they can't serve in the executive branch, but there's nothing stopping them. If state representatives and state senators are routinely delegates at state conventions, what's stopping members of Congress who are rightfully part of the problem? And you know what really bugs me? It's Jim DeMint and Tom Colburn, both Republicans. Colburn was working for convention states, now DeMint is. These guys, their voting records in Massachusetts, they look pretty good because we got a bad group. But pretty much they weren't actually that hardcore conservative. If you look at voting records, they were, and Tom Colburn supported the bailout, the Bush bailout, and then he defended it. This guy was part of the problem, and now he comes around and tells us, oh, if we don't have a balanced budget, it's our fault if the country collapses. No, the fault was on guys like Colburn and guys like DeMint, and they point to Reagan as their Reagan was a big supporter. He only vetoed one unbalanced budget in 8 years. He was part of the problem, you know. So, well, let's now that we're about halfway through the show, let's get into Agenda 21. Now, Tom, as we predicted, they've rebranded it, so you can talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, last year they had yet another massive meeting with 40,000 delegates and all that, and they came out with Agenda 2030. Now, I say all the time, you know, when I keep saying Agenda 21, people come up and want to correct me that no, it's Agenda 2030 now, and I keep saying no, it's the same thing. All they do, about every 10 years, they have another, meeting or change the name. In 2000, it was the Millennial Summit, and, they came out with the Millennial Project, and they had 8 goals then in 2000, all based on redistribution of wealth. We're going to end poverty by 2015, on and on and on. So 2016, of course, they didn't end poverty at all. We have more poverty. So they come up with a 2030 agenda, and they've got, 17 goals now. It's exactly the same goals they had in 2000, exactly the same goals they had in 1992. They're just being more specific about where they're headed with it. And they do this to keep their own troops excited, to keep them in the field and keep pushing this. So, you know, that's what it's about, but what it's really about, you know, they tell us this is about protecting the environment and having sensible development for our communities and so forth. That's the excuse. What they said over and over again when Agenda 21 was introduced was this is a comprehensive blueprint for the reorganization of human society. And I've got document after document here where they keep using that term. I've got an American Planning Association newsletter from 1994. Now, if you go into the American Planning Association's website, they have this whole section there about how, oh, this is all a lie about Agenda 21. We have nothing to do with it. We're not part of this at all. But here's this 1994 newsletter from Upper California, San Francisco area. And it's there's one paragraph in there that ties the American Planning Association in with Al Gore, his book Earth in a Balance, the President's Council on Sustainable Development, and it says in there, an Agenda 21 is a comprehensive blueprint for planning.
You know? By the way, do you have is that available on your website? Have you scanned that in? That'd be a great
document. You know, I don't think I have done that.
Yeah.
We need to do a lot of things like that.
That'd be great to have it. It may be available somewhere online, too. Because
yeah, well,
there's one book that came out. It was right in the wake of the meeting in Rio in 92. It was called, A Children's Guide, Saving the Planet, A Children's Guide to Agenda 21. They were very bold about that term back then. Today, that was just, they were just a bunch that had nothing to do with anything. It was just a harmless meaning. It didn't mean anything. You know, we just showed up, leaders from all over the world just showed up to throw balloons out of hotel windows and go for a nice swim. That's what they want you to think, you see.
Yeah.
But you mentioned the American Planning Association. Weren't they hired by Bill Clinton to take the Agenda 21 and turn it into something that can be implemented in the United States, and aren't they the ones that commit towards a sustainable America?
Well, that's what they do. They are the most respected planning group in the country. I keep hearing that. They're the largest, and they are in almost every community. And this is what they do. They go in there and put these plans together, and they have these consensus meetings. They say, this is all mm-hmm. local. This is the word
visionary
here
sessions.
All the time. Yeah.
Now they call them charrettes.
Yeah.
Charrettes, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Tom, if I'm hearing this for the first time, and I might be living in suburban Boston or rural Maine or rural Alabama, and I'm saying, well, how do I know this is being implemented in my town or my county? I mean, the convenience store is still there. I can still get gas at the gas station for $2.20 a gallon. What things can I see or look for that may lead to Agenda 21 being implemented in my community?
Well, first of all, you're going to hear your city fathers come out with, we've got a new vision for development for the community, and we want the community involved, and you're going to hear about that. You're going to hear terms like smart growth. You're going to hear them talking about reducing your carbon footprint, cutting back on energy use, finding alternative energy, controlling water quality, and then you're going in the smart growth programs, you'll begin to see downtown areas redeveloped is a word you'll hear, and suddenly you know ethnic neighborhoods or low income neighborhoods are under the bulldozer, and you have condos being built there. We're beautifying downtown. We're it's a walkable community. We're all we're going to get rid of all these darn cars that are in the way. Mm-hmm. We're going to be able to ride our bikes, and we're going to have light rail train systems, and on and on and on. It's just for the future, and those are the kind of things you'll begin to hear as this is put together.
Now, one of the things I'm seeing, I live in Boston, Massachusetts, and I'm seeing not just in Boston, but in the outlying regions, cities and towns, most of which are members of the entity called ICLEI, I-C-L-E-I, International Council for Local Environmental Initiative.
Right.
Sounds like a Japanese monster movie, you know, which that
it
wouldn't
is.
Be so bad. It's worse. But
yeah.
Anyway, you see these bike paths, and we're not talking about bike paths off a beaten track somewhere, like a rail trail, and that's another issue, but we don't have time to get into. But you see these complete bike paths on busy streets in Boston. Their streets tend to be narrow, and they didn't plan 100 years when they just built as needed. So you've got these bike paths, and all of a sudden you'll see a little bike path take up a foot or two of the road that used to be maybe a breakdown lane. Now it's a bike path, and then the bike paths disappear because the road narrows. So instead of the bike path, you see a little stencil of a bike. It should be a little stencil of a bike and a person on the ground had just been hit by a truck.
Right.
That might be more appropriate. And I have a good friend who's a real into stats, and he knew nothing about this. And as I'm giving the presentation, talking about complete streets, he's going on, the number of people killed in bike accidents has gone up 3 or 4 times in the last 5 or 6 years. Well, of course, because more people are on bikes now, and they're driving these bikes on dangerous roads. So talk a little bit about that, if you could.
Well, the whole point of the smart growth program is to make it more difficult to drive, so eventually you won't want to. They put the speed bumps in the middle of residential neighborhoods, and I always joke that now you're going to get into these little environmentally correct cars where you can get 1.5 people in them, and and now you have to drive up this side of the speed bump and over to that side. These are very uncomfortable to drive, and it makes you think, I don't need to get in the car today because I don't want to drive through all that. As you mentioned, the bike lanes. This is when people they talk about bike lanes and share the road, and most of the times they kind of paint this picture. Well, it's the family with the kids. We're going to go out in the countryside and we're going to take our bikes out there and just be nice. That's not what this is about at all. You go back to the story of Jenny Granato in Montgomery County, Ohio, down in Dayton, where they bulldozed her front yard and put a bike highway there, and I stay at the bike highway because this is for multiple bicycles, came within 7 feet of her front door.
Wow.
And, you know, they literally rendered her 150-year-old farmhouse useless. She can't sell it. It's hardly livable. You know, the idea is to have a vision like downtown Saigon with bicycles everywhere and get people out of their cars. The new thing they're doing with cars, there was a big debate in the Obama administration. Apparently, they finally settled it. Taxing every mile you drive through the year.
Mileage tax, that's right.
Mileage tax, yeah. One of the things they were talking about, what would the federal government collect it would be the states. Well, Oregon came out to be the first state to start to do this, so obviously they settled the argument. But, you know, you take your car in for a state inspection. Every new car now today, over the last 10 years, has got this black box in there, and they can tell everything about how you drove, and particularly they can find how many miles you drove. So you go in to take your car for state inspection, they read the meter, and send you a bill for how many miles you drove. So all these things are designed to get you out of your car. In New York, they're setting up these plazas in the middle of, like, they took 5 blocks of street out of Broadway in Times Square.
That's right.
Putting this in there, making it more difficult to drive in New York City. And the person who was in charge of all this said, you know, our goal is to change the culture. We're going to get you out of your cars. That's what it's all about. So step by step by step, they get you out of your cars. They now have you, you know, we're spending immense amounts of money in every community across the country for trolley cars or light rail trains. I was speaking down in Atlanta a few years ago, and they were pushing the light rail train system there, and they had come out with these statistics saying, this is how many riders we expect to be on there, and this is what we believe the cost will be to raise to build this. Well, this guy took that cost and that ridership and did an overlay and did a calculation and figured out that for every rider that they predicted they were going to have for the cost that they were going to cost, he could buy every one of them a limousine and throw in, you know, a chauffeur as well.
Amazing.
For this cost.
Amazing.
And of course, the costs are always much higher than they predict them to be. So
always.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was about the bikes, too. You live in the Northeast or Northwest. It's not very practical because we get cold weather, we get ice, and we get snow, and then you have a heavy rain. And, you know, bikes are great, and they've been around before the internal combustion engine, but they're not going to be the panacea. And, so, you know, as you get older, you might have little nagging injuries. So, outside of a short 2 or 3 miles, that's not practical. I'm going to commute 10, 20 miles on my bicycle, round trip. That's not going to happen. Even running errands, you don't need to run an errand to the store. You have a family. Of course, the idea is to have no children or very few children, so you don't have to worry about that. But I'm going to bring back 4 or 5 bags of groceries on a bicycle. You know, I just don't think that's very practical. Even and these smart cars, I don't know why they call these little death traps, they're nothing more than lawnmower engines with, you know, that are enclosed. These things are suicidal. They should be called suicide cars, not smart cars. Nothing smart about going into those things. And again, 1.5 people. And that's, I got a family here. I got a family of 5 children. There's no way we could use one of those things. Even if I lived on an island like Nantucket, it wouldn't be practical. So, It's really, they call these smart cars. I would call them very stupid cars. But it's all part of this agenda. Now, we got a minute left. So tell us how people can get involved contacting your organization.
Our website is AmericanPolicy.org. And on the site, we've got all kinds of articles. We've got tools we've created, manuals and booklets and so forth that teach people what this is about and give them history and how to fight back. And working on a new book that is going to come out about all this, and we're going to start a whole new project on getting people involved in fighting back. But AmericanPolicy.org will give you all the details.
And, folks, there's been a lot of success stories around the country, and I know that American Policy Center has been instrumental in many of these. So that's the idea, is to just understand the issue and then get active locally. So, Tom, thanks so much for being a guest. And, folks, thanks for listening.
Thank you.
And until next week, you're listening to Camp Constitution Radio on WBCQ. May God bless you.